mortality rate. People are reliable that way. Yes. That's why I'm here, actually. I moved in to take care of my mom after my dad died, and when she died, I inherited her co-op membership.
Ah. When was that?
3 years ago. So, maybe that's why you're a member of the co-op, but don't pay attention to the building's business. Jen shrugged. I thought you said hardly anyone did. Well, the reserve finances are a little esoteric, but it's a co-op, you know. So, actually, a lot of people keep their hand in the game one way or another. I probably should, Jen allowed. Charlotte nodded at this, but then something else struck her. Everyone's going to know pretty soon about something that came up at the last board meeting. There's been an offer made on the building.
Someone wants to buy the whole building?
That's right.
Who?
We don't know. They're operating through a broker. Jen had a tendency to see patterns. No doubt it was an effect of her job, and she recognized that, but she couldn't help herself. As here, someone disappears from a building, they have powerful relatives and colleagues, the building gets an offer. She couldn't help wondering if there was a connection.
We can refuse the offer, right?
Sure, but we probably have to vote on it. Get an opinion from the membership, even a decision. And the offer is for about twice what the building is worth, so that will tempt a lot of people. It's almost like a hostile takeover bid.
I hope it doesn't happen, Jen said. I don't want to move, and I bet not many residents here want to either. I mean, where would we go?
Charlotte shrugged. Some people think money can solve anything.
Jen said, how can you tell if their bid is twice what the building's worth? How can anyone tell what anything is worth these days?
Comparisons to similar deals, Charlotte said.
Are deals like this going down?
Quite a few. I talk to people on the boards of other buildings, and Lemus meets once a month, and a lot of people are reporting offers, even a couple of buyouts. I hate what it means.
What does it mean?
Well, I think that now that sea level appears to have stabilized and people have gotten past the emergency years, well, that was a huge effort. That took a lot of wet equity.
The greatest generation, Jen quoted.
People like to think so.
Especially people of that generation.
Exactly. The comebackers, the water rats, the what-have-yous.
Our parents.
That's right. And really, they did a lot. I don't know about you, but the stories my mom used to tell, and her dad?
Jen nodded. I'm a fourth-generation cop, and keeping some kind of order through the floods was hard. They had to hold the line.
Unsure. But now, you know, Lower Manhattan is an interesting place. So people are taking investment opportunities and regentrification.
New York is still New York, and Uptown is a monster.
And billionaires from everywhere like to park money here. If you do that, you can drop in occasionally and have a night on the town.
It's always been that way.
Sure, but that doesn't mean I have to like it. In fact, I hate it.
Jen nodded as she regarded Charlotte. She was on the watch for any signs of dissembling, because Charlotte had connections with the missing men in more ways than one, so there was reason to be attentive. And she was a woman of strong opinions. Jen was beginning to see why her youthful marriage might have failed. A financier and a social worker walk into a bar. But in fact, Jen saw no signs of dissembling. On the contrary, Charlotte seemed very open and frank. Although it was true that being forthcoming in one area could be used to disguise withholding in other areas. So she wasn't sure yet.
So, you'd like to stop this bid on the building? Hell yes, I would. Like I just said, I don't like what it means, and I like this place. I don't want to move.
I think that will be the majority opinion, Jen said reassuringly. Then she shifted gears fast, a habit of hers. Pop a surprise and see if it caused a startle.
What about our super? Could he be involved in this?
In the disappearance? Definitely surprised. Why would he be? I don't know. But he has access to the building's security systems, and the cameras went out right when they went missing. I don't think that could be a coincidence. So there's that. Then also, if this hostile takeover bid wanted inside help, they might offer some people here a better deal if they took over. Charlotte was shaking her head through most of what Jen had said. Vlade is this building. I don't think he would react well to anyone trying to fuck with it in any way. Well, okay. But money can make people think they're helping when they aren't, know what I mean? I do. But he would see anything like that as a bribe, I think. And then people would be lucky to get away without getting thrown in the canal. No, Vlade loves this place, I know that.
He's been here a long time?
Yes, he came here about 15 years ago, after some bad stuff happened.
Meaning trouble with the law?
No, he was married, and their child died in an accident, and after that the marriage fell apart, and that's about when we hired him.
You were on the board even then?
Yes, Charlotte replied heavily. Even then.
So you don't think he could be involved with any of this?
That's right. Now they were both done eating, coffees emptied, and they knew the urns would be empty too. Never enough coffee in the Met. And Jen could tell she had managed to irritate Charlotte more than once. She had done it on purpose, but enough was enough. For now, anyway.
Tell you what, she said, I'll keep looking for these guys. As for the building, I'll start coming to the member meetings, and I'll talk to the people in the building I know about holding on to what we've got.
This came down to just a few next-door neighbors, but she hoped just saying it would pour some oil on the waters.
Thanks, Charlotte said. There'll always be meetings.
New York's most congested time was 1904, or 2104. The city lies at latitude 40 degrees north, same as Madrid, Ankara, Beijing. How's all the big money in New York been made? Astor, Vanderbilt, Fish. In real estate, of course, observed John Dos Passos. I come in from the canal. I don't know anything. It is well and good to ask what we need to know. William Bronk, descendant of the Bronx, Bronx.
E. Vlade. Mayday, the Met, said from Vlade's wall monitor. He had chosen a woman's voice for the building, and now he found himself sitting up in bed reaching for the light and then his clothes. What's up? He asked. Report. Water in the sub-basement. Shit. He leaped up and threw on his Carhartts. How much, how fast, and where? I have reported the first sensing of moisture. Speed of inflow not established. Room B201. Okay, tell me the speed of inflow when you have one. Will do. Vlade clumped downstairs to the sub-basement, and the lights came on ahead of him as he moved. The sub-basement was not only below the waterline, it was below the rock line as well, as it had been cut into bedrock at the time of the building's construction, in the first years of the 20th century. Every part of the building but the tower had been replaced in 1999, when the foundation had been dug deeper still. No one then worried about waterproofing, and the bedrock had cracks in it, as all rock did. When the island had been dry land, that hadn't mattered, but now it did, as water from the canals seeped slowly but inexorably down cracks in the rock. The concrete cladding the walls of the sub-basement was therefore harder to seal than on the floors above, because you could get to the outsides of those higher parts of the wall either by diving to them or by caissoning the canals. Access was all, and given the lack of access, he could only seal the sub-basement on the inside surfaces of its walls. This was profoundly unsatisfactory, as it left the concrete of the walls and floor exposed to seep, and thus getting degraded in the usual ways, corrosion, melting, slumping, disintegration. But there was nothing to be done about it. Because of this unsolvable problem, he kept the sub-basement empty, its floor and walls entirely clear. Some people on the board complained that this was a waste of space, but he was adamant. He had to be able to see what was happening. It was one of the worst vulnerabilities in the whole building. So when he hurried into room B201, he could see all of it immediately. A big, bright space, looking wet everywhere, because the lights reflected off the so-called diamond sheeting that covered every surface. It was actually a graphenated composite, but as it was transparent and shiny, Vlade, like everyone else, called it diamond. It was not quite as hard as diamond, but it was more flexible and could be applied as a spray. Really, the new composites were simply wonderful when it came to strength, flexibility, weight, everything you wanted out of building materials. They made submarine living possible. The floor was slightly knobbled to create better footing. The walls were smoother but brushed like brushed aluminum, precisely to reduce the glare of reflected light. What it meant was a glitter instead of a glare, a glitter as if everything were damp and sparkling with dew. It was enough to give him a little startle of dismay, even though it always looked this way. That being the case, he had to search around to find the leak. The building had indeed reported the first sign of moisture. He only found it by deploying his humidity sensor wand. The damp spot was in the far corner, where the north wall, east wall, and floor met. Which was odd, as a point like that was precisely where the sheeting got sprayed thicker than usual. Still, this was where the wand was pinging. He sat down on the cool, knobbled floor, brushed his hand over it. Yep, wet. He smelled the damp, got nothing, took his flashlight from his tool belt and aimed the strongest beam at the corner. It took some moving of his head back and forth to find the right focus for his old eyes, but finally he spotted it. Fracture. Microfracture. But this made no sense. He whipped out his pocket lens, leaned over on his knees, and held the flashlight at an angle, moved the lens in and out. Blurry, big view of the blob of diamond spray that had congealed or dried or what have you in the corner. Fracture, yes. Welling water in the crack grew till the surface tension on it broke and it slid onto the floor, just as it would have at larger scales. But fuck if the hole didn't look drilled. He swabbed the corner clear, took a macro photo with his wrist pad. The crack indeed looked round, like two little holes, actually, the water welling up hemispherically like blood from two pinpricks. Clear blood. Damn. He swabbed it again, then pasted over the corner with a dab of leak stopper. He wanted something more substantial for later, like a thick spray of sheeting, but for now this would have to do. Vlade, the Met said in his earbud. Mayday. Water in the mid-basement, southwest corner, room B104. How much? First detection of moisture. Speed of inflow undetermined. He hustled up the broad stairs and across the room surrounding the stairwell to room B104, favoring his bad left knee. The rooms on this floor were smaller than the ones on the floor below. He kept them equally empty against the walls, though their middles were filled with boxes, in stacks he had organized himself. The floor was ordinary concrete, the walls diamond-sheeted as below. Here, the outside of the building was in water even at low tide, as was true of the floor above it, the old ground floor. The one above that was intertidal. Right now it was high tide, so there would be a little more pressure on any submarine leaks, but for two leaks to spring at almost the same time struck Vlade as extremely suspicious, especially given the corner position and drilled look of the one below. Again, his humidity wand led him quickly to the leak, which was low on a wall. Here the wall was sheeted both inside and outside, so a leak made even less sense than the one below. This one looked like a crack rather than a pinprick, like a stress fracture, perhaps. Water oozed from the bottom of the crack, which was almost vertical. Beads of water, welling up and dripping down the wall. God damn it. He gooed the crack with another liberal dab of leak stopper, thought it over, then stomped around the elevator shaft to his room. He got out of his Carhartts and into his swim trunks, cursing all the while. The lower leak would necessarily have been drilled from the inside. He didn't want to give any oral commands to the building about the security cameras, because the camera issue had not been resolved to his satisfaction yet, and the whole system could be compromised. So he would have to wait to check that until others were there to help and witness. First order of business was to inspect the outside of the building to see if the higher crack extended all the way through to the outside. If it did, that would be simpler than if it was a complex leak in which the interior crack was not matched by an exterior one. But either way was bad. The dry suits and dive tanks and gear were in the boathouse, in a storage room next to his office. People were getting out in their watercraft without undue stress, it seemed, and Sue nodded nervously to him that all was well. "I'm going to take a quick dive," Vlade told him, which caused Sue to frown. Dives were never supposed to be solo, but Vlade did it all the time around the building, accompanied only by a little subsled. "I'll keep the phone on," Sue said, to remind him, and Vlade nodded and began the somewhat arduous process of getting his dry suit on. For building inspections, he could use the smallest tank, and the headset was just a mask settling onto the hood like a snorkel mask. The seal was not completely hermetic, but good enough for brief work near the surface, and he could scrub down afterward. There were steps down into the water inside the boathouse. Only three were now exposed, which meant it was almost high tide. Down he went, feeling like the swamp thing from the eponymous movie, the scariest movie of all time, in his opinion. Happily, he was not dragging some poor, rapidly aging maiden down with him, nor even the sled, which was not needed for a dive like this. The water was cold, as always, even in the dry suit, but he had been warming up so fast that it felt good to be cooled. Submerge, quick test of the gear, then out the boathouse door into the bacino, swimming horizontally. The dry suit's feet were just slightly webbed and finned, and that too felt good. Headlamp on, powerful beam, nevertheless mostly catching the particulates in the god-awful water of the city, as always. Actually, the hundreds of millions of clams in the aquaculture cages all over the intertidal were doing yeoman work in filtering clean the water. Now he could usually see at least 2 or 3 meters, and sometimes more. Stay deep enough to not get knocked on the head by some boat's keel or prop, but high enough not to run into the bacino's aquaculture pens. The familiar weightlessness of neutral buoyancy, of horizontal underwater life. Lots of fish in the highest cages, salmon, sea trout, catfish, the sinuous schools of fishy bodies all turning together against the cage sides. Swim around the northwest corner of the building, hovering over the old sidewalk like a ghost. Sidewalk, curb, street. Always a little stab of the uncanny to see these signs of New York as it used to be. 24th Street. Around the corner, float to the spot on the wall outside room B104. GPS to be sure he was there. He put his face to the wall and inspected the diamond sheen inch by inch, running his gloved fingers over it too. Nothing super obvious. Ah yes, right outside the inner crack, it seemed, an outer crack. What the fuck? Vlade had spent 10 years in the city's water division, working on sewage lines, utilidors, subway tunnels, and aquafarms, mostly. So being underwater in one of the canals was about as ordinary to him as walking the streets uptown, or indeed more ordinary, as he hardly ever went uptown. The surface overhead surged slightly back and forth like a breathing thing. Opalescent sheen to the east where the sun was rising between buildings. Wakes crisscrossing, slapping against the Met and North, rebounding and breaking against each other, bubbles coming into being and snapping out of existence. A glimpse of the sun now, shattering on the water when he looked east along 24th. All normal, but still he found himself creeped out. Something was wrong. Just to be sure, he swam to the building's northeast corner and shined his headlamp at the juncture of building and sidewalk, looking 5 or 6 meters on both sides. This was always a weird sight, with the goo that sealed the juncture of building and ancient sidewalk looking like congealed gray lava, and the sidewalk itself diamond-sheeted, even to a certain extent the old street surface. This was the weak point for every building still upright in the shallows of lower Manhattan. You could only seal surfaces so far out from the building, and beyond that, they were permeable. Indeed, one of the projects of city services was to caisson and pump out every drowned street in the city, about 200 miles of streets all told, and diamond sheet every surface up to above high tide, before letting the water back in. This could only ever be partly successful, as of course there was already water everywhere down there below street level, saturating the old concrete and asphalt and soil, so they would be sealing some of it in while keeping the rest out. It wasn't clear to Vlade that this would be particularly useful. Closing the barn door after the horses had leaked, as far as Vlade and many other water rats were concerned, but the hydrologists had declared it would help the situation, and so slowly it got done. As if there weren't more pressing chores on the list. But whatever. Looking at the edge of the sealant and sheeting and the beginning of bare street concrete, now a canal bottom, Vlade could feel in his gut why the hydrologists had wanted to try something. Anything. Inspection complete, he swam slowly back into the boathouse and clomped dripping up the steps, this time reminding himself of the creature from the Black Lagoon. When he was out of the dry suit and had sprayed down his face and neck with bleach and washed that off and dried himself and gotten back in his civvies, he called his old friend Armando from Lamass's Submarine Services. "Hey, Mando, can you pop over and take a look at my building? I got a couple of leaks." Mando agreed to schedule him in. "Thanks." He looked at the photos on his pad, then turned to his screens and called up the building's leak records. Also, after some hesitation, the building's security cameras. Nothing obvious. But then again, after checking his log, there was nothing recorded on the basement cameras, even on days when people had definitely gone into those sub-basement rooms, as recorded in the logs. Often after a dive, he felt queasy. Everyone did from time to time. They said it was nitrogen buildup, or anoxia, or the toxic water with all its organics and effluents and microflora and fauna and outright poisons, the whole chemical stew that made up the city's estuarine flow, my God. It made you sick. That was just the way it was. But today, he felt sicker than usual. He called up Charlotte Armstrong. "Charlotte, where are you?" "I'm walking to my office. I'm almost there. I walked the whole way." She sounded pleased with herself.
"Good. Hey, sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but it looks like someone is sabotaging our building."
Alfred Stieglitz and Georgia O'Keeffe were the first artists in America to live and work in a skyscraper. Supposedly. Love in Manhattan? I don't think so. Candace Bushnell, Sex and the City. LaGuardia, I'm making beer. Patrolman Manila, all right. LaGuardia, why don't you arrest me? Patrolman Manila, I guess that's a job for a prohibition agent, if anybody. LaGuardia, well, I'm defying you. I thought you might accommodate me.
F. Amelia. Amelia's airship, the Assisted Migration, was a Friedrichshafen Deluxe Midi, and she loved it. She had called the autopilot Colonel Blimp at first, but its voice was so friendly, helpful, and Germanic that she switched to calling it Franz. When she ran into trouble of one sort or another, which was the part of her programs that her viewers loved the most, especially if the trouble somehow lost her her clothes, she would say, "Oh, Franz, yikes! Please do a 360 here and get us out of this!" And Franz would take over, executing the proper maneuver, whatever it might be, while making a heavy joke, always almost the same joke, about how a 360-degree turn would only get you going the way you were already going. Everyone had heard it by now, so it was a running joke. Or a flying joke, as Franz called it. But also, in practical terms, part of a problem solved. Franz was smart. Of course he had to leave some decisions to her, being judgment calls outside his purview. But he was surprisingly ingenious, even in what you might have called this more human realm of executive function. The blimp, actually a dirigible, if you acknowledge that an internal framework could be only semi-rigid or demi-rigid, made of aerogels and not much heavier than the gas in the ballonets, was 40 meters long and had a capacious gondola, running along the underside of the airship like a fat keel. It had been built in Friedrichshafen right before the turn of the century, and since then had flown many miles, in a career somewhat like those of the tramp steamers of the latter part of the 19th century. The keys to its durability were its flexibility and its lightness, and also the photovoltaic outer skin of the bag, which made the craft effectively autonomous in energy terms. Of course, there was sun damage eventually, and supplies were needed on a regular basis, but often it was possible to restock without landing by meeting with sky villages they passed. So, like the millions of other similar airships wandering the skies, they didn't really ever have to come down. And like millions of other aircraft occupants, for many years, Amelia had therefore not gone down. It had been a refuge she had needed. During those years, there had seldom been a time when she couldn't see other airships in the distance. But that was fine by her, even comforting, as it gave her the idea of other people without their actual presence, and made the atmosphere into a human space, an ever-shifting Calvinosity. It looked as if after the coastlines had drowned, people had taken to the skies like dandelion seeds and recongregated in the clouds. Although now she saw again that in the polar latitudes, the skies were less occupied. 200 miles north of Quebec, she spotted only a few aircraft, mostly big freighters at much higher altitudes, taking advantage of their absence of human crews to get up into the bottom of the jet stream and hurry to their next rendezvous. As they approached Hudson Bay, Franz dove steeply, altering their pitch by pumping helium around the ballonets and by tilting the flaps located behind the powerful turbines housed in two big cylinders attached to the sides of the craft. Together, these actions shoved their nose down and sent them humming toward the ground. The October nights were growing long up here, and the frozen landscape was a black whiteness to every horizon, with the icy gleam of 100 lakes making it clear just how crushed and then flooded the Canadian Shield had been by the great ice cap of the last ice age. It looked more like an archipelago than a continent. Near dawn, a glow of light on the horizon to the north marked the town they were visiting, Churchill, Manitoba. As they dropped over the town and headed for its airship field, they saw it was a desolate little knot of buildings, far enough down the western shore of Hudson Bay that it got no traffic from the busy Northwest Passage, except for an occasional cruise ship visiting in the hope of seeing whatever polar bears might remain. which were hardly any. This was mainly because the bears were now stuck on land every year from the breakup of the sea ice in the spring until it refroze in the fall, a disappearance that kept the bears away from the seals, which were their main source of food. That meant they were so hungry they never had triplets, nor hardly twins. And when they came through town to see if they could walk on the new sea ice yet, they also looked around to see if there was anything to eat in town. This pattern had existed for over a century, and the town's polar bear alert program had long ago worked out a routine to deal with the October influx of bears headed for the newly frozen ice, tranquilizing ursine trespassers and blimping them in nets to a point downcast where early ice and seals both tended to congregate. This year, rather than blimping all the trespassers out of town, the program officers had kept their holding tank full, with the idea that some of these jailed bears, the most obnoxious in the region, had self-selected to be the ones to get airlifted much further south than usual. After Franz attached to an airship mast at the edge of town and was pulled to the ground by a local crew, Amelia got out and greeted a clutch of locals. Actually, it was very close to the total population of the town, she was told. Amelia shook everyone's hand and thanked them for hosting her, filming all the while with a swarm of camera flies. After that, she followed them across town to the holding tank. "We're approaching the polar bear jail in Churchill," Amelia voiceovered unnecessarily as she filmed. Her team was not sending this out live, so she felt more relaxed than usual, but was also trying to be conscientious. "This jail and its animal control officers have saved literally thousands of polar bears from untimely death. Before the program was started, an average of 20 bears a year were shot dead to keep them from mauling people here in town. Now it's a rare year when any bear has to be shot. When they get through a season with no bear deaths, a gigantic polar bear snowman is built to celebrate the achievement by the human citizens of the town." She filmed the pickup trucks that were going to convey her transpolar emigrants from the jail to the assisted migration. These were hefty pickup trucks, with snow tires taller than she was. Polar bears did not hibernate, she was told, so during their trip south, they would be confined to the big animal rooms at the stern end of the airship's gondola, configured to make a single big enclosure. Apparently, it had been decided that they would tolerate the voyage better if they were accommodated communally. Amelia's producers had prepared the room in advance of departure and stocked the craft's freezers and refrigerators with the seal steaks needed to feed them en route. As the local program officers used a crane to hoist the drug and netted bears into the pickup truck, then drove them over to the airship, Amelia filmed and spoke her voiceover, ad-libbing in the knowledge that later editing would change it all anyway. "Some people seem to not understand what a problem extinction is. Hard to imagine that, but it's clearly true, because we haven't been able to get everyone to agree that moving some polar bears back into a truly polar environment is their last chance for survival in the wild. 20 bears are going to be transported eventually. That's about 10% of all the polar bears left in the wild. I'll be taking 6 of them. So, if by doing that, we help them get past this moment into a viable future, their genetic bottleneck from this century is going to be as skinny as a life straw. But it's better than extinction, right? It's either this or the end. So I say, load them up and ship them out." The bears, sedated and netted, looked disheveled and yellowy. The huge pickups backed up to the stern bay door of her airship's gondola, where a little portable crane was wheeled up and used to lift one netted bear at a time onto a small forklift, which was dwarfed by its load, but held the ground well enough to hum up the ramp into the animal's room. During their trip, the room would be kept at Arctic temperatures, and everything a polar bear might want in autumn was on board. The trip south was scheduled to take 2 weeks, weather permitting. Soon after the bears were on board, they were ready for liftoff. Fran slung their hook, and off they went, rising a bit slower than usual, being some 5 tons heavier. A week later, they ran into a tropical storm coming north from Trinidad and Tobago, and Amelia asked Franz to head for the west fringe of the storm circulation, which would give her viewers a dramatic edge-on view of what might become a hurricane, while also pushing them southward in its counterclockwise flow. The storm was now named Harold, which was Amelia's younger brother's name, so she started calling the storm Little Brother. As a totality, it was moving north at about 20 kilometers an hour, but its western edge was whirlpooling such that its winds pushed southward at about 200 kilometers an hour. That gives us a net assist south of about 180 kilometers per hour, Amelia informed her future audience. Which is great, even if it only lasts for a few hours, because the natives are getting a little restless, it seems to me. She said this with her usual moo of tolerant dismay, her raised eyebrows and bugged-out eyes giving her a Lucille Ball look. Always good. The camera flies buzzing around her would add to the effect with their fisheye lenses. The bears were supposed to be entering into their winter mode, which was not hibernation, but rather a state that made them kind of like zombie bears, as one of the program officers in Churchill had put it. But it sure didn't sound like it to Amelia. From aft came subsonic, stomach-vibrating, vaguely leonine roars, and also barks suggestive of the Hound of the Baskervilles. Unhappy polar bears? She asked. Are they looking out the windows at the storm? Are they hungry? They seem so upset. Then they were caught by the outer edge of Harold, and for almost 10 minutes, the noise of the wind was tremendous. They were buffeted hard, and whether the bears were still complaining was hard to tell, as it was too loud to hear anything. But Amelia's stomach was still vibrating like a drum head next to another drum getting hammered, so it seemed like they probably were. Hold on, folks, Amelia said loudly. You know what this is like. The airship is going to be loud until it gets up to speed. Of course, there's hardly any resistance to us speeding up. It's not like a ship on the ocean, which took me a while to understand because up here, we basically move with the wind. So the wind doesn't fly by us like it would a ship or even an airplane. If we shut down our turbines, we just get carried along with whatever wind there is. That's why we can fly in hurricanes without danger, as long as we don't try to go anywhere other than where it wants us to go. Just bob along like a cork on a stream, slow or fast, doesn't matter to us. Right, Franz? Although this time, it was pretty bumpy. There was turbulence as the whirlpool of wind interacted with the slower air around it. Things would go better when they moved a bit further into the hurricane, as Amelia explained, not for the first time. Even so, it would still stay a little bumpy. They were in clouds, and a cloud was like a diffuse lake, with some choppiness in it created by the variable distribution of water droplets, so that even when they were pulled to the ambient wind speed and were flowing in the flow, they were also deep in cloud, and the quick shuddering vibration and occasional dip or swing meant the sense of speed was still there, even though they couldn't see anything. This bumpiness is part of the laminar flow, Amelia narrated. The cloud itself is shimmying. Although maybe it was just the airship, flexing its aerogel frame. Amelia felt sure it was not usually this bumpy inside clouds, even hurricane clouds. They weren't resisting the wind, weren't trying to crab out of the storm, just riding the flow, with Franz trying to modulate the up and down of the cloud's internal waves. And yet, still, they were rocking hard, irregularly, both up and down and side to side. I don't know, Amelia announced. It doesn't make sense, but I'm wondering if this rocking is being caused by the bears. It didn't seem likely, but nothing else seemed more likely. Probably the bears weren't throwing themselves from side to side in an organized manner. Anyway, she hoped not. They weighed some 800 pounds each, so even without coordinating their motions, even just banging about, or perhaps fighting each other, throwing each other around like sumo wrestlers, yes, they would certainly have enough mass to rock the boat. The airship was only semi-rigid at best, and highly sensitive to internal shifts of weight. So, if they were carrying an enraged cargo... Bears and bears and bears, oh my! She went back down the central hallway to take a look. There was a window in the hallway door to the animal's half of the gondola, so she grabbed a hair clip camera and clipped it to her hair, and looked in to see how they were doing. The first thing she saw was blood. Oh no! Red on the walls, some of it spattered drops, some of it claw marks. Franz, what's going on here?
All systems normal, Franz reported.
What do you mean? Take a look.
Look where?
In the bear's room. Amelia went to the tool closet in the hall, opened it, and took a tranquilizer dart gun from the mounting on the back wall. Returning to the hall door and looking through the window, she saw nothing. So she unlocked the door and was immediately knocked back as the door burst open into her. Bloodied white giants ran past her like dogs, like immense albino Labrador retrievers, or big men in ill-fitting white fur coats running on all fours. She lay sprawled against the far wall, playing dead, and luckily did not catch any of the creature's attention. She shot one with a trank dart in the haunch as it ran forward along the hall toward the bridge. Then, when they were out of sight, she scrambled to her feet and ran to the tool closet. She leaped in and pulled the door closed after her, twisted the handle latch into place on the inside, and right after that, heard the door thumped hard on the outside. Great big paw whacking it hard. Oh no! Locked in closet, at least three bears loose in the airship, possibly six, airship in hurricane. Somehow, she had done it again. Franz?
I am for an art that tells you the time of day or where such and such a street is. I am for an art that helps old ladies across the street, said Kleis Oldenburg. The streets are 60 feet wide. The avenues are 100 feet wide. You could fit a tennis court across one of the avenues. It was said that the streets were designed with the idea that the buildings lining them would be 4 or 5 stories tall. The leaden twilight weighs on the dry limbs of an old man walking towards Broadway. Round the Needix stand at the corner, something clicks in his eyes. Broken doll in the ranks of varnished and articulated dolls, he plods up with drooping head into the seethe and throb, into the furnace of beaded letter-cut light. I remember when it was all meadows, he grumbles to the little boy. John Dos Passos, Manhattan Transfer.
G. Stefan and Roberto. Stefan and Roberto had not found a chance to recharge the battery that powered their boat, so they walked on Skybridge's west and got on the 6th Vapo north to go see their friend Mr. Hexter. It was raining hard. The canal surface is crazy with fat raindrop pox, and the splash sprinkles around the pox, their little rings expanding out into bigger rings, all overlaid on boat wakes and the perpetual scalloping of a strong south wind. Crazy gray water under a rolling gray sky. Movement everywhere they looked. People waited on the docks under rain shelters, if there were any, or stood under umbrellas, or stoically out in the downpour. The boys stood in the bow with big plastic jackets on, getting wet. They didn't care. Low tide revealed the dark green bathtub ring on every building in the neighborhood. 11-foot tides, people said. The incoming flood tide was what the boys wanted to exploit on this day, by stopping on the way to Mr. Hexter's at the Street of Fundy, meaning 6th between 32nd and Central Park. They left the Vapo at the dock next to Ernesto's deli on 31st and borrowed a couple of Ernesto's skimboards and dry suits. From there, they walked up the West 6th boardwalk, which ran like a flat awning across building fronts, to the long triangular bacino where 6th and Broadway met at 34th, just north of the low tide line. This was the start of the Street of Fundy, yet another renaming of this section of 6th, and much better than Avenue of the Americas, a cheesy politician's name more suitable for Madison Avenue, or Denver. Now this stretch had a very appropriate name, because tides on the Street of Fundy were shocking at both flood and ebb. This stretch of Midtown was the widest part of the intertidal, a mess for the most part, but interesting, a zone of squatters and scammers and street people out to have some fun. People like Stefan and Roberto, who loved to join the skimboarders who congregated when the rising tide, coming up both Broadway and 6th, combined to surge hard up the slight incline of 6th, each advance of the white foam hissing north with startling rapidity, especially if pushed by a south wind. If you stood at 40th and looked south during the flood tide, you saw the bay's edge sluice up the green slick in low waves, rolling over the mat of waxy seaweed leaves and rushes of white foam, reflooring the street a long way before the verge of foam stalled and sucked back, then crashed into the next incoming white surge, throwing up a little white wall that quickly collapsed and folded into the next onrush. All that action meant that if you were riding the surge on a skimboard, as Stefan and Roberto soon were, you could cut around on the mini brakes, shoot across the street from curb to curb, turn on a dime in the curb slush, or jump the curb and turn in doorways, sometimes even catching the rebound wave coming off buildings and jumping off the curb back into the street. Stefan and Roberto joined the group with some whoops to announce their presence. The group's objections were duly noted and rejected, and off they all went, skimming up block after block with the tide's rise, jockeying for position on the surges, doing spinners if possible, curb turns, stepping off if necessary, even falling from time to time. Which could be painful, as the water was never deep enough to keep you from hitting asphalt, although even 4 inches could cushion the blow, especially if you trusted the water and pancaked on it. Then also, 6th was flat enough across the top of the intertidal, especially between 37th and 41st, that the last surges of a good flood tide could carry you in a single shot all the way up to the high tide mark, where asphalt, though cracked and worn, returned to being mostly black rather than mostly green. The intertidal always tended to be green. Life. Life liked the intertidal. It was fantastic to feel the resistance of water getting squished between your board and the street, a sensation that was perfectly tangible underfoot, so much so that you could shift your weight just a tiny bit, using the most exquisite precision, and cause the board to shoot forward over the water, keeping it from touching the street by margins ever so small, a tenth of an inch off the street, and you were still frictionless. If you didn't purl, the world was a whirl. And if you did bottom out, you just ran off the board, turned and caught it before it barked your ankles, threw it ahead of you, and ran and jumped on it again, nailing the landing just right to press straight down on the board, and off you went again. It was also very cool, if you stuck around till the start of the ebb tide, to see the water run back down the street. You couldn't ride it. That didn't really work, though diehards always tried. But it was great just to sit there in the street, wasted and glowing in your dry suit, and watch the river just run away, sucking down the street as if Mother Ocean had breathed in deep or was prepping some gnarly tsunami. Seemed at that moment like the whole world might dry out right before their eyes. But no, just the ordinary tidal suck. It would stabilize again down near 31st, the low tide line, beyond which you had the true lower Manhattan, the submerged zone, their home waters, their town. Great fun all around. Afterward, they pulled off Ernesto's ratty old dry suits and sprayed each other down first with bleach, then with some water drained through a jumbo life straw, after which they toweled off shivering and wincing at their cuts, which were almost sure to get a little infected. Then they thanked Ernesto as they returned his stuff, promising to make some deliveries for him later. Lot of verbosity with the other regular skimmers who stashed at Ernesto's. There weren't that many of them, because the falls could be just a little too brutal. So it was a tight group, one of the many small subcultures in this most clubbish of cities. When they were dried and dressed and had wolfed down some day-old rolls Ernesto had knuckleballed at them, they walked west on plank and cinder-block sidewalks to 8th, into the maze of drowned Chelsea. Here, almost every building that had not collapsed had been condemned, and rightfully so. When in spate, the Hudson tended to run hard through this neighborhood, and the foundations here were not set on bedrock. Concrete turned out to be quite friable over the long haul, and while steel was stronger, it was usually set in concrete, so rusty or strong, it became irrelevant as its moorings crumbled. Once a state law had been passed condemning the whole neighborhood, Mr. Hexter had said, but naturally people had ignored the law and squatted here as much as anywhere else. It was just that the law was probably right. So the neighborhood was quiet. They made their way on planks set on cinder blocks to a rude stoop dock, consisting of planks nailed on top of pallet-sized blocks of old styrofoam, tied in front of a low brownstone on 29th. There was no one in sight, which was weird to see. Without intending to, they lowered their voices. All the buildings in sight had windows broken, and only some of those were boarded up. Many were empty holes, generally a reliable sign of abandonment. There was not a single unbroken glass window to be seen. It was quiet enough that you could clearly hear the slop of waves against walls and the hiss of bubbles bursting, all filling the air with a susurrus that was strangely pleasant to hear compared to the city's usual honk and wail. The two boys looked around to see if anyone was watching. Still no one. They ducked into the brownstone's open door and made their way up a moldy, battered staircase. 5th-floor walk-up. Floorboards creaking underfoot. Smell of mildew and mold and unemptied chamber pots. Essence of New York, Roberto noted as they shuffled down the dark hallway to the end door. They knocked on it using the old man's code for his friends, and waited. Around them the building creaked and reeked. The door opened and the wizened face of their friend peered up at them.
Ah, gentlemen, the man said. Come in. Thanks for dropping by.
They entered his apartment, which smelled less than the hallway, but inevitably did smell. Quite a bit, actually. The old man had long since gotten used to it, they assumed. His room was very shabby, and crowded with books and boxes filled with clothing and crap, but it was orderly for all that. The piles of books were everywhere, often to head height or above it, but they all were 4 square piles, with the biggest books at the bottom, and all the spines facing out for easy reference. Several battery and oil lanterns perched on these stacks. Cabinets had drawers that they knew were full of rolled and folded maps, and the room was dominated by a big cubicle map cabinet, chest high. A sink in the corner had a bulb of water draining down through a jumbo life straw into a bowl resting in the sink. The old man knew where everything was and could go to anything he wanted without hesitation. He did sometimes ask them for help in moving books, to get to a large one at the bottom of a pile, but the boys were happy to oblige. The old man had more books than anyone they knew, more, in fact, than the total of all the other books they had ever seen. Stefan and Roberto didn't like to talk about this, but neither of them could read. They therefore liked the maps most.
"Have a seat, gentlemen. Would you like some tea? What brings you here today?"
"We found it," Roberto said.
The old man straightened up, looked at them.
"Truly?"
"We think we did," Stefan said. "There was a big hit on the metal detector right at the GPS spot you gave us. Then we had to leave, but we marked the spot and we'll be able to find it again."
"Wonderful," the old man said. "The signal was strong?"
"It was pinging like crazy," Roberto said. "And the detector was set for gold."
"Right under the GPS spot?"
"Right under it."
"Wonderful. Marvelous. But the thing is, how deep could it be down?"
Stefan asked. How deep will we have to dig? The old man shrugged, frowned. His face made him look like a child with some kind of wasting disease.
How far down can the metal detector detect?
They say 10 meters, but it depends on how much metal, and how wet the ground is, and things like that. He nodded.
Well, it could be that deep.
He limped over to his map cabinet and pulled out a folded map.
Here, look at this.
They sat on each side of him. The map was a USGS topographical map from before the floods, of Manhattan and some of the surrounding harbor area. It had both elevation contour intervals and streets and buildings, a very crowded map, on which the old man had also drawn the original shorelines of the bay in green, and the current shorelines in red. And there in the South Bronx, inland from the shore, as drawn by the USGS mapmakers, but underwater when considering both the red and the green lines, was a black X. Hexter tapped it with his forefinger, as always. The middle of the X was even a little worn.
So, you know how I told you before, he said, his usual preface. I told you before, the HMS Hussar takes off from down near Battery Park where the British have their dock. November 23rd, 1780. 114 feet long, 34 feet wide, 6th-rate, 28-gun frigate, crew of about 100 men. Maybe also 70 American prisoners of war. Captain Maurice Pohl wants to go through Hellgate and into Long Island Sound, even though his local pilot, a black slave named Mr. Swan, advises against it as being dangerous. They get most of the way through Hellgate, but run into Pot Rock, which is a rock shelf sticking out from Astoria. Captain Pohl goes down to inspect and sees a giant hole at the bow of the ship. He comes up saying they have to ground the ship and get everyone to shore. The current is carrying them north, so they aim for either Port Morris on the Bronx shore or North Brother Island, called Montresor's Island at the time. But glug, down they go. It all happens too fast, and down goes the Hussar, in such shallow water that the masts are still sticking out into the air when it hits bottom. Most of the sailors get to shore alive in boats, although there was a rumor for a while that the 70 American prisoners all drowned, still chained below decks. So that's good, right? Roberto asks. What? That 70 Americans drowned? No, that it was shallow where it went down. I knew you meant that. Yes, it's good. But very soon afterward, the British got chains under the ship's hull and dragged it around, trying to pull it back up. But it came apart, and they never got the gold. $4 million of gold coins to pay British soldiers in 2 wooden chests bound with iron hoops. 4 million in 1780 terms. The coins would have been guineas or the like, so I don't know why they always give the value in dollars, but anyway. Lots of gold. Oh, yeah. By now that amount of gold would be worth a gazillion. How much, really? I don't know. I think a couple billion. And in shallow water. Right. But it's murky, and the river moves fast in both directions. It's only calm there at ebb and full tide, about an hour each, as you boys know. And they broke the ship trying to haul it up, so the ship was distributed up and down the riverbed, probably. Almost certainly. The gold chests probably didn't move very far. There they are, down there still. But the river keeps changing its banks, ripping them down and building them up. And in the 1910s, they filled in the Bronx shore in that area, made some new docks and a loading area behind them. It took me years in the libraries to find the surveying maps that the city workers made before and after that infill. Plus, I found a map from the 1820s that showed where the British went when they came here and tried to pull the ship up. They knew where it was, and twice they tried to salvage it. For sure they were going for the gold. So I was happy to put all that together and mark it. And later I figured out the GPS coordinates for the spot. And that's what you went to.